Backseat Producers, special episode number 8, an interview with In 3. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Tony.
Come on.
And this is Adam.
And this is Daryl.
And we are the Backseat Producers. And this is going to be a special episode. This is going to fall out of the sequence of our regular recording schedule. We have been given the opportunity to... What?
You are recording, right?
Yes, I am recording. I remembered this time.
All right. Sorry. Continue.
We have been given the opportunity to speak with some gentlemen from a company called In3. And guys, why don't you go ahead and say hello?
Hi there. I'm Neil. I'm CEO.
And I'm Matt. I run production.
And you guys do, if I understand correctly, you turn movies into 3D films. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but we should probably just point out that traditionally the way stereo movies have been created in the past, in fact, any stereo photography, was basically taking two cameras and mounting them more or less the same spacing between an adult's eyes. But what we do is we create stereo from a single camera source. So we can take old movies and we can turn them into stereo as if they've been shot in stereo, or we can work on brand new movies and not have to burden the producer of the movie with a dual camera rig. Mm-hmm.
That's cool. That's very cool. So when you talk about the stereo filming, this would be similar to what everybody thinks of as the old school 3D film with the red and the blue glasses.
Well, we have to stop you right there because everybody says those red and blue glasses, but in fact, the old school 3D in the movie theaters used polarized lenses. The red blue anaglyph is with comic books and some of the print media. So it's and it's the worst way to look at 3D.
Agreed.
But, yes.
But also the our father's 3D from the 50s when the first wave really hit. There were a lot of technical problems that plagued seeing good 3D in those days, but the glasses were actually polarized lenses.
Okay. Now, some of the we had some questions that we kind of looked at. One of the things that in looking at your website, we go ahead and say it's in-3d.com, and because they're In looking at the website,
it's actually in-3.com.
I'm sorry, in-3.com. And we'll have a link in the show notes when we release this episode. There is a ton of information about exactly some of the technical stuff you guys do in this. But some of the questions I had going through this, you have a term that you use on your site called dimensionalization. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. That's our trademark term for how we convert 2D content into 3D. And we've trademarked it because we actually have a proprietary process. We actually have 6 issued patents on the core technology that we've developed. There are many ways to do conversions, but ours is particularly special. And I should point out that we basically set out to do this starting back in 1998, actually.
Wow.
And our goal always was to convince the top creatives in the studios and people like Peter Jackson and George Lucas and Jim Cameron that this was a viable and actually even perhaps better way of creating stereo content. So we had a very high bar that we set for ourselves, and then that's why we call it dimensionalization as opposed to other techniques.
Sure.
Was there a specific breakthrough back in 1998 that made you believe that you could harness that type of technology?
To be honest, in 1998, we didn't know if it would work. We had an idea. And the real serious R&D work started in 2000, which is when I got involved. And we didn't know whether this would work until about 2003. We started to show it to people in the industry in 2004. And we got in front of George Lucas while he was still in the middle of shooting the third episode. And when he saw it, he was amazed, and he said, you know, I've seen a lot of people try to do what you guys are doing. You're the only ones who pulled it off, and I don't want you leaving here until everybody here has seen this. And then I want a system of my own so I can show it to my friends. So
nice.
He really kind of put us on the map, and that's how we were introduced to Jim Cameron and Peter Jackson and others.
Wow.
And again, back then, there were really no way to show high-quality 3D in a digital environment. It was just the beginning of the conversion of theaters to digital.
Right.
So we were way ahead of the curve.
I might want to ask here, is the dimensionalization process just limited to conventional film, or is it just limited to digital projection right now?
No, it's not limited in any sense in terms of us creating high-quality stereo. Once you have the left and right image, how you show it, the best way to see it right now is in the theater on a big screen. And you have several different systems that all do a great job of showing very high-quality stereo. But we're not confined to film or digital or any content. We can take and actually have in an early demo, we did old Laurel and Hardy movies. I mean, there's nothing out there that can't be dimensionalized. But and also, I should add that you'll be able to see it in your home. There already are what are called 3D ready sets that you could buy, you know, at your local retail outlet. What's missing is a Blu-ray DVD format in 3D, and that will come along in the next year or two.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. There's a lot of work going on, and Panasonic and others have. There's, you know, different formats that are being proposed. So once there's a standard, then you'll see in the home very easy to do.
Now, one of the things that we have not mentioned to this point is that there is a film in theaters right now that is on your resume of things that you've worked on.
Yes, we did. It's actually a very unique film, and people probably will watch the film and enjoy it and not really understand how unique it is. But the movie is G-Force, and it's a Walt Disney, Jerry Bruckheimer Films production. And if you see G-Force, you know, it's the story of an elite group of guinea pigs and other interesting animals that can carry out missions to save the world from an evil billionaire. But all of the live action sequences in that movie we dimensionalized or were converted from 2D to 3D.
Nice.
But the movie itself, of course, the bulk of the movie is seeing the CGI characters, the guinea pigs and the mole and the fly and all that. So but it's the marriage of live action and special effects that's unique in this movie. It's the first time it's ever been done.
When that movie was being filmed, did the producers come to you to do the effect shots for this, or did you approach them as, hey, this is what we can do to bring this feature to your film?
Well, actually, it was kind of an interesting, convoluted process. when the movie was first thought of, they considered testing us, dimensionalizing live action versus shooting it traditionally with dual cameras. And we were about to do that test when they decided, no, never mind, this movie's not going to be in 3D after all, it's going to be in 2D. And so they went off and they shot the movie in 2D, and about halfway through it they said, no, we've changed our mind, we want this in stereo after all. And so
no doubt. Yeah, no doubt.
Now
they saw the
rushes.
They
really had to do a conversion at that point.
Yeah, sure.
Because they only had the asset as a all the live action was only shot single cam. But luckily, they were very pleased with what we could do.
So essentially you took the CGI characters that had been developed in 2D and then you applied your dimensionalization process to them.
I'm sorry. The live action shots, the actors and everything, we dimensionalized. But the characters, that was all work done, excellent work by Sony Imageworks.
Oh, okay.
And, you have to really...
So the effect you applied was to the whole film, not just to sections of it.
No, we did sections and we married them together. I'll let Matt explain how we did it.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was running production at the time of that project, and so N3's part of G-Force was the pure live-action shots, and then Sony, their part was rendering out the CG shots with two perspectives, and the whole movie as... basically a lot of guinea pigs. So they handled a large portion of the film, and we handled the balance.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds...
And as Neil's saying, marrying those two is an extremely extremely important part of the process, and that's one major thing that we were able to really achieve with Sony in this project is working together so the live action and the rendered elements would cut seamlessly together. That is really kind of a first.
Yeah, absolutely. If you think about it, they have control over creating these characters, but if their characters don't match the scene as shot, the live action scene, you're not going to buy the whole thing. You're going to think something's not right. What we brought to this is that we could make the live action match to conform to what they've already created or were creating, and vice versa. And we really feel strongly that this is the way live-action movies ought to be done that have lots of effects in them, because it's the effects work that really challenges everybody. And if you believe it, then we've pulled it off.
Wow. Right.
Okay.
Right. Now, one of the things that I'll go ahead and toss out there also is that there is a companion blog to your website as well.
Yes.
And there's a lot of good things on there. One of the things I saw was an interesting description of how the dimensionalization process could be used not only in an action film, but for example, like in a romantic comedy.
Absolutely. One of the things that's going to happen now that everybody is beginning to see that 3D is not a gimmick, but it's really a way of drawing you into the story. And by the way, I like to call what we do surround sound for your eyes. The idea of the new 3D is not that it's a theme park ride or it's a gimmick. It's a way to draw you into the story more. And just as you would go and choose a theater that has surround sound rather than one that just has, plain old stereo, we feel, and I think the people who are making 3D movies feel very strongly that 3D adds, this added element that draws you into the story. So, I've lost my train of thought on this one.
Don't worry, it happens all the time.
That comes from talking to us, I'm sure.
No, what's your question? Because there is a point.
It was basically related to how 3D would work in a romantic comedy.
All right. So what we're finding is that when people come at 3D initially, they think, we have to have lots of fast action cuts and lots of action and all. And actually, it's just the opposite. When you watch a good stereo movie, you want to dwell on that scene. You want things. You don't want things happening very quickly because there's so much more going on to draw you in. So a romantic comedy and things that you think probably aren't suitable for 3D may very well turn out to be the things that people prefer to see in 3D.
So in other words, you're saying it that in some ways the 3D will enhance what we come to know as just great cinematography.
Absolutely. And, we on a demo, we did 12 Angry Men. So you got everybody in a jury room, but you've got the whole, claustrophobia of sitting there, and it's just dialogue and all. But nonetheless, the 3D draws you in more to that story.
You actually bring up a really good point that 3D can really be in that same realm and level as cinematography, because really with our process, that's what we try to do. We look at what the cinematographer and the director chose with archive films, and we try to underline that. A director may shoot a scene with a long lens, so it appears like the monster behind the main character is closer to them than they actually are. Well, because we have complete control over the depth, we can underline that fact and actually position those characters closer together, or maybe in a reverse angle as the person's running away and you see their path to escape, maybe we make the road feel longer and actually appear longer. So you can really do some interesting things that use depth as a storytelling tool.
Sounds like you've raised the bar for the cinematographer way high here with all the effects you can achieve with this.
Well, you know, you have to, even in a movie like Up, you may or may not be aware, but they were shaping the depth of the characters to match the emotional content of a scene. Mm-hmm. And so they began to use the 3D just, you know, in a much more creative way. And we're going to see a lot more of that as people get comfortable with this medium. And we can do that now with live action.
Yeah, sounds like you're going to have to train a whole new generation of cinematographers to take advantage of this.
Well, but that's exactly how we got this generation of cinematographers. Mm-hmm. You know, the language and the choreography of films has evolved from time. You know, the very first movies were, train coming at you and everybody in theater,
ducks. Yeah.
So it's going to be a very similar thing. Stereo is going to bring out new ways of thinking about how the movie is made. And again, a good movie, the sound is so important, and it's sort of always, not given perhaps the same level of importance, but it really makes the movie. And it could be the same thing with how you do your depth script in stereo.
Sure.
So you've added the extra dimension now of not only your sound field, but your visual scape is now taking on a whole another dimension in itself.
Yeah.
It's just an extra artistic tool, and really, at the end of the day, with dimensionalization specifically, cinematographers get off kind of easy. They get to use all the same tools that they're used to using. And then basically the 3D is something that is used to complement those choices after the fact.
Well, it really sounds like the 3D part of the process is just another level of artistic creativity that's added on to that. If the person who is applying the 3D effects doesn't have a level of creativity and art involved in it, it's...
Well, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, it sounds like they could ruin something good if it's not good.
Well, that's what I mean. You've raised the bar up here quite high on this.
Yeah, and it's not just the cinematographer though, because if the cinematographer puts forth, we could take a great piece of cinema like Gone with the Wind, for example. Mm-hmm. I can imagine just like how like The Burning of Atlanta would look
from a different
perspective, and done through a dimensionalization process, would make it just that much more powerful.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We have a power to do good and evil.
Yeah, that's the only. Yeah, the only concern here is, again, you get a lazy director and a cinematographer in here trying to geek out on this technology, and they kind of just ruin it for everybody.
Well, but then on the other hand, you're going to have the artists that will film with this process in mind once they've gotten used to it. I mean, is that correct? Or?
Oh yes, we absolutely. And I think, for somebody coming to it new right now, it seems pretty formidable. But once you start working in this medium, and especially if you're working with us and the tools that we bring, will actually bring a lot of comfort, because we're doing all this in a post-production process. And we have an immense amount of control. So that's good and evil, because you could spend a lot of time. There's no one right way any scene can be done. It's really the artistic intent of the director. And some will get it, and some will, maybe not.
Yeah, there's
it really is a new tool.
Yeah, there's the danger of, again, them sitting in front of the monitor sort of like trying every possible combination and permutation and never ever finishing the movie.
Well, it could happen. But I think that once... when we work with people, we actually find that, we sort of begin to get inside their head
and help guide them through
really
what they're trying
bad.
To do.
Yeah.
So when you work with older movies, does it help to have, for example, a Sergio Leone film where you already have a long lens and you have definitely more landscape and close-ups to work with, or does it, or it, can you actually do more where there's less depth already in the framing of the film?
Interesting. Yeah, it really comes down to questions of composition. I mean, if you do have a telephoto lens and whatnot, you know, you can get great shaping out of people's faces where it may normally be difficult to do that if you're shooting. And there you're essentially ending up with two levels of depth. And that can work and can be interesting. You know, I think it's a new visual medium. And while those shots work, you know, also kind of the same rules that you get with normal composition, like having perspective lines that lead your eye, that can really underline what can be done in 3D, or you know, framing a foreground, midground, and background, that translates very well to 3D. So, you know, all the great filmmakers of the past, you know, they were a lot of times thinking of things in 3D, so it can effectively be converted.
When you do The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, let me know. I'd love to purchase a copy of the 3D Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Sure.
Yeah.
Actually, I just keep going back to seeing the test footage of 12 Angry Men. That just sounds
that's
so amazing.
that was done many years ago when we were really early in the process. But we tried all the genres, and we would go and we would be invited to studios and we would show everything, and it was wonderful because we'd have the technical people there, we'd have the marketing people and distribution, you know, everybody wearing a different hat, and they all had different opinions on what should be done in 3D and what shouldn't be, mm-hmm. and what would work and what wouldn't. And, you know, I think once the public gets to see this, a similar debate's going to go on. It's going to be great. You know, some people are going to like certain things, and others, they're going to say, no, why'd they bother to do that? But, you know, to be able to see this tool, it's funny because nowadays when we do our demos, we're showing a lot of material where we were being tested by the studio. So these were hard scenes and,
right.
and things of that sort. But at the very end, we throw up something that we did 5 years ago when we still had lots of issues, let's put it this way. And it was taken from a DVD. It's the last 5 minutes of Casablanca. And everybody who sees that, when they come away, they love the Casablanca better than all the brand new, you know, mm-hmm. 4K or 2K resolution material that we had. And the reason is because of that story and because mm-hmm. they got drawn in, you know, just as Maisie Strauss is getting shot. So,
yes.
You know.
So then you don't have a, I guess in my mind, my thought is, do you have a difficulty marketing the universal appeal of the technology, or are people very receptive right off the bat to the making of a, for example, a conventional drama as opposed to a science fiction high action special effects film? Or are you basically getting a lot of takers on the high action sci-fi end and having trouble trying to communicate with, you know, the more conventional filmmaking approach?
Well, what you're describing is we have to educate folks, because mm-hmm. a lot of people have been used to thinking of 3D or horror movies, that's perfect for 3D, or science fiction, that's
sure.
perfect.
Right.
And what's funny is, and I'm not going to mention who it was, but somebody well-known felt that they needed a lot of fast-cut action scenes to promote a particular movie.
Gee, fast-cut action scenes? I can take a wild guess. But what
we found, and others, and in fact, just very recently, we had a new director looking at 3D, and he made the comment. He said, "You know, the older films are going to really lend themselves to this because the pace allows you to dwell on the scenes. Mm-hmm. It's not this fast paced, you know, cuts very quick
right.
and all of that.
Right, right.
So
yes,
he
curse,
got it right away.
Yeah, the curse of the MTV generation.
Well, and I think the you know this kind of technology and this kind of imagery would really lend itself to the slower pace and you
right.
can really see the nuance of it.
Yeah, exactly. The subtleties of it, because the adding the depth in the post-production really, I mean, the classics lend themselves to that because they've survived this long because they're classics. And if you can enhance that experience subtly, then
Yeah,
it's got to absolutely.
I can't wait to see the whole Casablanca.
But honor the classics mm-hmm. and draw you into that story.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. I did. We tossed out to some of the folks we know on Twitter that that we were going to be doing an interview, and just to see if anybody else had any other questions, just in general terms of 3D, if you know what kind of questions might come up. Had a couple of technical questions from a guy we know who is who's an artist, and to be honest, I'm not an artist, so I don't fully understand the questions, but I'm sure that you guys might. One is, how do you deal with the motion blur and camera focus when doing something like this?
Okay, I'll take those separately. The motion blur has essentially a transparency effect, because the element that's blurred out is actually those pixels are mixing with the background. Mm-hmm. So we really have to extract that out and recreate that transparent effect in stereo. So there's a variety of techniques to do that, and you know, traditional keying techniques, but also ground up recreation of that blur. And in terms of lens blur, that'll be like, I'm thinking the guy's probably talking about, you know, like an over the shoulder shot when the foreground character is mm-hmm. out of focus.
Right.
Similar kind of thing there, where you can actually extract out the information you need and or recreate it. But the key is, those things can be really pleasing. And the key is to get that transparency to look realistic in 3D. And if you do that, it looks great.
Cool. All right. Another question, the same guy. He goes by the great Mr. Chibi, by the way, because I know he will be thrilled when he hears his name in this. How do you determine the focal length for the shots?
Well, it's interesting because our process really does not rely on a camera paradigm. Some of the other processes that are out there, and you know, camera techniques and CG rendering techniques, are based off of real or virtual cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Our process is really about basically pixel shifting, if you will, but it's really kind of taking a 2D approach at creating a 3D effect. And so we don't get a lot of that mm-hmm. overhead that you really do get when you're in a virtual environment using cameras. You have to conform to certain rules, whereas we don't really have that. So in terms of determining the focal length of a shot, we don't.
Okay.
We don't really. We try to do something that visually matches what the director already did.
Mm-hmm. Okay, while we're geeking out here on stuff, I might as well ask, since we're all a bunch of computer geeks here, hardware platforms that you use to render these, is this a proprietary render farm that you use, or is it pretty much off-the-shelf hardware?
The hardware is off-the-shelf. The software is our own software.
Mm-hmm.
But it runs, you know,
it runs close to real time. In some circumstances, it does, especially when we're just working on depth. Our artists see updates in terms of depth instantaneously on full resolution files.
So this is a real time process. You do not have to sit there and wait hours and hours for it to render the scene.
Wow,
that's right. No, it's real time. Yeah,
that's
or
cool.
close to it.
Yeah, that's another advantage we get by not having to conform to kind of normal CG paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we actually can sit in a session and in real time show a director and move objects and do anything he likes in the scene. It's not fully cleaned up,
right?
But certainly all of the 3D depth information is visible, and it can be manipulated in real time.
Yeah, actually, that's something that we're continuing to push more and more in terms of the limits of our software and whatnot. And essentially, that's something that we want to offer directors. It's very similar to color grading, where you can sit in a DI suite and the director can noodle with the color all day long in real time, in context.
Mm-hmm.
They're able to do that with depth.
Dang.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that is pretty incredible.
We call it depth grading.
Yeah.
Depth grading.
So,
wow.
So like, I want to ask the last thing on here on the rendering process. Is this something that fits in the size of a building or under a desk or in a cabinet?
Oh yeah, under our desk.
Yeah, these are standard workstations.
Yeah, standard engineering workstations. Now that is fantastic.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you guys come out to LA, we'd be happy to show you our stuff. There's a lot of things we can't show the public. But
road trip. Yep.
Yeah. When's Comic Con again?
One last question from Mr. Shibby, and this kind of goes into the viewing experience. How are you, or are you attempting to deal with the loss of color that polarized glasses can cause?
Boy, this is a real big issue, and it's a serious issue. The light levels in theaters right now are very low. 4.5 foot Lamberts mm-hmm. is good, and that compares to the standard which they would like at 14 foot Lamberts. But here's an interesting thing. You don't need to light up the screen to the same brightness of 2D. You do need to light up the screen better than where we are right now.
Uh-huh.
The question is, where in that range is it going to end up? But it does have an impact, and nobody has a really good solution at the present time because, for example, one of the very popular and excellent ways of seeing stereo in the theater right now is the Real D system. Mm-hmm. And they put the shuttering mechanism in front of the projector, and the glasses are very, very inexpensive. In fact, they're giveaway glasses, and they're polarized lenses. They have a system, though, that recaptures some of the light they're throwing away the mechanism at the projector, and they can double the light level with this new system. And that's great. So they can light up big screens, 70-foot screens. They can rival the IMAX, the real IMAX, I should point
out. Right.
Size screens. But what's happened is that some of the theater owners will put in a system like this just so they can lower the light level and get more lamp life out. So you can see the dilemma. I mean, we need to educate the theater owners and the exhibitors to making sure that there's an adequate light level. And first they actually have to have the hardware that could light up more. And that's been a problem up to now, because more than 50% of the light is lost through any of the systems that are out there.
So to get the best out of your process and whatnot, you almost have to sit there and dial in the theater somewhat to get it to match what you're projecting.
Well, it's really not just our process. I think all the 3D content creators, basically, we're at the mercy of the projection environment. Mm-hmm. We just create the content, and then we're at their mercy.
Unlike getting a theater THX certified, there's no equivalent standard for 3D projection certified.
Not yet. This is going to come up. Right now, I think everybody is willing to put up with the low light level because 3D is still compelling, even at the low light level.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The trouble is there's a lot of physics at that light level. There's different responses of the eye, and there's a whole bunch of research that needs to be done because nobody knows in stereo what that light level needs to be to work, because it really doesn't have to be as bright as 2D. We know that.
Right, so what's going to work for the little cine versus the giant multiplex is going to be considerably different.
So I think in time this is going to be solved, but right now it certainly is a question mark.
But no matter what happens, probably the drive-in theaters are never coming back then, since you guys are the future, right?
I wish the drive-in theaters would come back.
We still have one.
We started out with the idea of converting the world's best movies in their libraries, and we still feel strongly about that. But the problem right now is there are not enough 3D-equipped theaters to recoup the investment.
Right.
And that's going to change soon, but we're really not quite there yet. Very close.
Do you still kind of see that theaters moving away from standard film projection into a more digital projection?
Yeah. Digital has a lot of advantages. If you think about the industry, there's kind of three areas of stakeholders. You've got the creative people, Spielberg and Cameron, the guys who make these movies. Mm-hmm. They were the first to say, we want to go digital. And the reason is because they wanted to guarantee that the consumers, the ticket buyers, would all get the same excellent experience of watching a movie that they get when they were sitting and looking at the answer prints, sitting in, you know, as they were editing these movies.
And
so they were on
completely.
Board early on. The moment digital was out there, they wanted it.
Yeah, I agree. The scratches suck.
So, yeah, exactly. Now, the second stakeholders are the distributors and the studios. And they came on board next because they realized that if the world was all digital and they didn't have to do any prints, they could save $1 billion a year in the cost of prints.
And not only just the cost of prints, but the reducing the amount of piracy that goes on.
Well, that's there are all kinds of advantages, but that sure. But you know, money talks. That was really important. Yeah. The third group is the exhibitors. They were the ones saying it's not broke and we don't need to fix it.
Yeah.
And what they were saying is, look, a film projector is a $30,000 investment. And maybe we change the light bulb every year and we fix a gear here or something, but it's, you know, it's a couple hundred bucks in maintenance and it right. lasts for 20 years. You're asking us to take that out and put in a computer, and every year it's obsolete. We got to upgrade and we got to, you know, it's going to be broken and we have, you know.
And you no longer have
a scary proposition.
Sure. And you no longer have a projectionist. You have a network administrator who is essentially doing the job.
Too, but the real point was it wasn't in it. Economically, there was nothing in it to them because they realized early on that they couldn't charge more just for being digital.
Right.
However, and by the way, it was Peter Jackson who pointed this out, and he was the one who suggested that we go in front of the theater owners in 2005. We did a show in Show West, and the idea was to show the exhibitors that if they went digital for a very small extra fee, they could show 3D. And 3D would be where they make the money.
Mm-hmm.
And when everybody realized that, all of a sudden, digital started to proliferate.
The lights went on, so to speak.
Exactly. So now there was something in it for the exhibitors. So everybody gets something out of digital. And absolutely, the arrow is already pointing to going digital. It's just a question of how quickly. And once again, money is the issue because it's an expensive thing to do that conversion. But once it's done, it's going to be a great thing.
Well, and I know as a movie viewer, and my wife calls me a snob, but I always look for the digital projection theater, the showings of the movie, because we have like a 20-screen theater here. One of the showings of a movie might be in standard film, and one of them's in digital. I always try to go to the digital before I'll go to the standard screen. And she calls me a snob for doing that, but, you know, like Daryl said earlier, the scratches suck.
Well, if you're going to go to a standard screen, go opening night.
Exactly.
Yeah, but if you go digital, opening night's every night.
And right. here's the weird thing, too. Here in St. Louis, we have a little three-screen art house called the Tivoli. And guess what? It's all digital.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They managed to recoup the costs fairly quickly.
Oh, yeah. I think that it's everybody would like to be there. It's just a question of how they get there. Who's really going to pay for it?
Right.
Right now, the scheme is that the studios, in essence, are seeding the first round of getting digital out there with this what they call virtual print feeds, and that was a way where the studios kind of stepped up to the plate, and the exhibitors didn't have to really commit a whole lot of money, but there's all kinds of political issues with that.
Sure.
So it's just not going as fast as anybody expected or hoped.
So it sounds like, you know, most of the hill you guys have to climb is education.
Absolutely.
Between the studios and the exhibitors.
Actually, the education that we would like is to get a movie out there, a legacy movie, and let the public educate the exhibitors and the
right.
studios.
Because oh, absolutely.
Yeah, educate really them with their it. Dollars.
Oh, and you can bet that I think this podcast would be completely behind that.
Yes, it'd really be nice if one wins an Academy Award. That would kind of like light a little fire under the
for a second
everybody.
Time. Yeah.
Very nice, yeah.
And now this is kind of a lay question, and maybe you guys can shed some more light on it. My wife asked this question just because we have young children, and for them, putting the glasses on, wearing the glasses through a movie is difficult at best.
Yes.
She said, will there ever be 3D movies without glasses? And if not, like, or you know, even if so, at some point, what are the limitations that keep 3D movies from being glassless?
That's a great question. Glassless projection or display is called autostereoscopic. And there are auto stereoscopic displays out there. There's a lot of work being done, especially in Japan and Korea and elsewhere. But to be honest, the display technology is quite crude and really limited to maybe at best 3 or 4 people looking at a display. You're not going to be able to go into a theater anytime soon and not wear some kind of glasses. However, there's another part of the question talking about children that is sort of neglected. We've done some research on this. When a 3D movie is shot traditionally with 2 cameras, the cameras are normally spaced apart the same spacing as adult eyes.
Right.
It's generally considered to be 65 millimeters. And that's great, but you know what? The interocular, which is that distance, is different for small children.
Mm-hmm.
And it affects how they see the 3D in ways that we don't know because we're not kids anymore. And so there's one issue that the glasses are not yet being put out there specifically sized for kids. I think that will happen.
Right.
But the question is, what are they seeing in terms of the 3D versus what's on the screen? That's not being addressed right now. So that's a whole other area that's sort of neglected.
And wow.
Even though most of these movies, of course, have been geared to kids.
Sounds like that would be a good research project for some up-and-coming PhD candidate to simulate that, to actually simulate what they're actually seeing.
Well, our podcast is huge with the Harvard crowd, so maybe that'll work out.
We wish.
Yes, all you MIT...
I'm just teasing.
All you people at MIT, there's your senior thesis right there.
No, there's actually a lot of research to be done in all aspects of viewing in stereo. And I think you'll see a lot of that now because finally there's money to be made in this.
What do you think about... You were saying that you'd like the public to educate, I guess, the distributors. What do you think about the future of DVD technology and that sort of thing, and how are you making the conversion to that technology?
Well, as I said, there are competing technologies right now that are not compatible in terms of the distribution of 3D in Blu-ray in particular. And, it's already debatable how much life you've got in any sort of a DVD release versus, getting your stuff on a download from the internet or other sources. But if they can resolve and get a standard, I think that people will really appreciate having a library of 3D releases, and this will be another revenue stream that will be, very, very good for everybody. But it has to happen relatively quickly, and in the past, you can remember the battle between HD DVD and Blu-ray,
right.
And even back further between Betamax and VHS. Well, those were only 2 competing formats. I got news for you. Right now, there's about 10 competing formats for the stereo thing. So, it's pretty formidable.
Sounds like we're going to be very bloody.
Yeah, could be. I hope not. But I should point out that the line in the sand was drawn just yesterday or 2 days ago when Panasonic announced that Avatar is going to be released on their format.
Oh, really?
And, wow.
Yeah.
Well,
and the Panasonic format, unfortunately, is not compatible with the Blu-rays that are out there right now. You'll have to buy a new Blu-ray player on the Panasonic approach. Other approaches are completely compatible with the Blu-rays that you have in your home.
Well,
so that's part of the debate.
So hopefully everyone will get together and kind of form a grand alliance like that was done for HDTV standardization, and they could solve this problem before we get too far along.
There is a lot of attention, and in fact this year I think will be a pivotal year to hopefully get people to come up with that format because it's going to be very important for the home anyway.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a bunch about how you're getting more and more directors who are on board with this, seeing the kind of tools that are available to them now. Just to toss this out here, what is the size of your company? And if every director who's making a movie next year says, I want to do this to my movie, how many people, how much time do you guys spend typically on that? Do you have the personnel if every movie maker said, I want to do this right now?
Sorry.
I hope someday every movie maker does say that. But we don't plan to be the gateway to that. This is going to be a whole industry for everybody mm-hmm. in post-production. Right now, the size of our companies, it's roughly 100 people. Mm-hmm. But we have outsourcing deals, and we're really just in the formative stages. There's only a handful of 3D movies that can be shown in a year right now because mm-hmm. of the lack of 3D theaters.
Right.
But as it grows, this will be a very, very big industry, and not just for us, but for everyone.
You can only hope is get as big as Technicolor.
No comment.
Actually, you can hope to get bigger.
Sure.
Yeah. No, we hope to be at the forefront, but we mm-hmm. certainly recognize there's going to be a lot of players here, and that's a good thing. This is really going to be something that the public appreciates.
Just a couple of final questions that we have at this point. The future of film, just in general. How do you see it progressing from here? We've heard a lot of gloom and doom about the decline of theater sales, ticket sales, people having big screens in their home and abandoning going to the theater because of the experience. Where do you guys see that, and how do you see that affecting what you do?
Well, I'm an old fogey, so you're going to get the old fogey view because, first off, right now there's an interesting thing happening. Even though we're in a economic downturn and recession and all, the box office is doing quite well and has held its own, if not grown. That's people, in the theaters.
People need distractions.
But what's dropped is DVD rentals and sales, and that's really spooked Hollywood. That's the problem.
Really?
This is a dichotomy, yes. Because you may not realize it, but when a new movie comes out, the way Hollywood looks at most of the movies, not the tentpoles, not the really big ones, but mm-hmm. most movies, the release in the theater is sort of the marketing, and then the money is made on the DVD. That's also plagued us in 3D because there is no 3D DVD. But regardless, the model is being challenged for lots of different reasons, and everybody has an idea of what's going on. My view is, first off, I would always prefer, if I could, to sit in the theater and see a big screen. But what I don't like is people talking in front of me and screaming and shouting and giving the plot away and all the rest of that. So I've tended not to go to the theater. I've tended to build a nice home theater and watch my favorite movies that way.
Right.
I think the future is, in terms of creating content, is still going to be all about a story. It's not about stereo or anything else or any mm-hmm. other gimmick. It's going to be about seeing a story that brings you in. So I don't think it's the future of it's interactive and all, because to me that's not storytelling. That's something else, and it's compelling in its own way. But once it gets interactive and you can change the outcome, you're no longer suspending your disbelief and allowing the director to take you wherever he wants you to go.
Right.
So that's me as an old fogey. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But
most movies, I don't know. We got thumbs up all around the studio here.
Yeah, we're all throwing thumbs up to this
to
notion.
Response. Because, it does start with a story. And to use a technological medium to enhance a great story, that's really what great storytelling in film is all about, and I think it's phenomenal that you guys approach it that way.
We got to. I had this little pipe dream that we would be able to give a really good excuse for people to see a movie like Casablanca on a 50-foot screen again. Where are you going to see it? Unless you go and, in stereo, there it is. But right now, the studios would prefer to remake Casablanca instead of taking the old movie.
Get
started on remakes.
Please
don't. Is that actually happening?
No, I hope not.
I don't know about that one. But,
good.
In your favorite movie,
I thought maybe you had something inside that we didn't know about. We were scared for a second. Then.
No.
Not surprising.
You can see where I'm going with.
Wow.
Absolutely.
That's a frightening prospect in and of itself. Right
well,
there.
You know, this does lend to one of my final couple of questions here. What movies would... I mean, you guys can do this. What movies, ideally, would you love to do or see, or maybe you've already done it? What classic films would you like to see done in stereo like this?
Everybody here has their own, their favorites, and I'm sure your audience has their own as well. like I said, movies that some people think wouldn't lend themselves to stereo are my favorites. And so, you know, 12 Angry Men was one of them, and Casablanca for sure. I'd like to see Lawrence of Arabia. You know, that's me.
From my perspective, I'm a younger guy, and I think The Matrix would be an unbelievable movie. It was just, in my opinion, shot for 3D.
Yes.
That's a good call on that.
I'd like to throw my vote in for The Blue Max.
Yeah.
I'll throw my vote in for what I always vote for, Raging Bull. Everything should be done to Raging Bull. It's the greatest movie ever made.
Okay.
All right. Well, unless anybody else has any questions, I have one last question. Can you tell us about any future projects, anything you guys have on the books that is going to be upcoming in the, you know, in the near future?
You know what? We can't.
we understand.
That's fair enough.
Believe me.
Do you guys want to hear about our upcoming projects? Or?
I don't think we actually have any.
We have a hard time figuring out really what we're talking about from week to week.
There's a bunch of exciting stuff happening.
Well, good. I mean, so there is stuff in the works. We'll be seeing your name in, you know, presuming within the next year or so.
Yes,
on some films. Excellent. That's, you know, I understand how it all works. I think most of us around this table have signed an NDA at some point.
Yep.
So we understand. Is there anything that you guys would like to say about the technology or your company that we may have missed through the course of this discussion?
Yeah, I don't know. We're just really pleased to talk to you guys or anyone else. Like I said, we just want to get this in front of the public. We think it'll sell itself after that. We don't have to say anything more.
Oh, I know that I'd be stoked to. I'd go out and see Casablanca and Serio tonight if it was available.
We are honored that you took the time to spend with us and introduce your product, and as a podcast for, you know, cinephiles, we are very excited about it, and we are sure that our audience will be excited about it as well.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, guys. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, too.
Did you forget you were talking?
No. I'm so used to stopping
it. We'll cut it before that.
We'll re-record that in post.
Yeah.
Not too much wine.
Editing is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, guys. Really,
thank
really
you guys so
it.
Much. We really appreciate the time.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye. See you.